It's 1906 GMT. Hello and welcome to this special edition of Focus on Africa. I'm Audrey Brown. We've redesigned our program to bring you an hour-long edition to discuss the efforts to stop Ebola virus disease. This hemorrhagic fever has so far claimed the lives of more than 1,000 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia and Nigeria. The rapid spread of the disease has frightened people and led to panic. Medical workers have been battling heroically on the front line, trying to save those infected. But poor health infrastructure, cultural practices, stigma, among others, has made it difficult to bring the outbreak under control. But can it be contained in less than 6 months, and what will it take to do so? These are some of the questions we'll be discussing in the next hour with my guests tonight. From Monrovia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Kodugo Mustafa Sano, who is Guinea's Minister for International Cooperation, also the President of the charity Médecins Sans Frontières, Dr. Joanne Liu in Geneva, and Dr. Chikwe Eyekihazu, an epidemiologist, specializing in infectious diseases, will join us from Malawi. And in the studio, we'll have Manji Chetu, who's a risk analyst for West Africa. Also, OB Sise, who's a Sierra Leonean political analyst based here in the UK. And please, I do invite you to send your questions and your comments via our Facebook page, BBC Africa, and also via text 447786205. And my colleague Kim Chakanetsa will be bringing us those remarks and comments and questions sent in by you. Welcome to all my guests. And I'll start by saying that today MSF sounded a warning that the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa will take at least 6 months to bring under control. The MSF International President, Dr. Joanne Liu, was speaking in Geneva following a trip to the region. She said that controlling the outbreak in Liberia, which has recorded more than 300 deaths, was vital to containing the epidemic. Dr. Liu is back in Geneva and she's on the line now. So good evening to you, Dr. Liu, and welcome. Why is it going to take that long to contain Ebola in West Africa, especially in Liberia?
I think what I was trying to convey was the fact that to contain the Ebola epidemics will take more time than what we are used to. And I was referring to what is our past experience with Ebola. In the past, we used to have, small epidemics in isolated village, and the chain of transmission would stop after a few weeks. But the reality that we are facing right now is cases that have been going on in the region since March. And so I think it would, to be a bit more realistic, we need to think more in terms of months than in terms of weeks to tame the epidemic of
Ebola. You were very specific also about Liberia, and you said it was central to containing the outbreak. Why is that?
I guess I've been misquoted. What I was trying to say was the fact that the different countries are at different stage with the epidemic right now. Guinea has been having cases for the last 5 months, Sierra Leone about 2 months, and then another few weeks. And so the case management and the response capacity in Liberia is still building itself. And the reality is, when we see how it has evolved so quickly, because we are talking about cases that happen in rural area and in urban area, more means will be needed to respond to the Ebola crisis right now.
One last question before I turn to President Johnson Sirleaf, who's on the line as well. What would you say needs to be done now that's not being done?
I think there is few things that are done, but I think it needs to be scaled up. And what needs to be scaled up is at the different, pole of intervention for Ebola. So more community awareness and mobilization needs to be done in order for the general population to understand what is Ebola and then change their fear into a channel, mobilize response to help to tame the epidemic. That's one thing. We need to work better at the surveillance of Ebola cases. So we need to get a better picture of where the cases are and how the chain of transmission is happening. We need to do the contact tracing of patients. So each person who's infected got at least 20 close contact that needs to be follow up and be observed for 21 days, the time of the incubation.
Okay.
This needs to happen, and we need to have more capacity in terms of taking care of patients being infected. Right now, MSF, we have one center in the county of Lofa and Foya. There's a 40-bed capacity, and as of this morning, there were 137 people with suspected Ebola.
Thank you very much, Dr. Liu. I do apologize for interrupting you there. Let's turn to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's on the line from Monrovia. Welcome, Madam President. What's your response to what you've just heard?
Well, first let me say why, in Liberia, we seem to have more of an intensification. That is because Ebola has entered our capital city, Monrovia, where one-third of the population of the country resides, and where communities are very heavily populated, very close in habitation, very much familiar with each other, moving around.
President Sirleaf, I'm so sorry, but the line is really, really bad. We can barely hear you here in the studio. What more of people who are listening outside in the field on even worse transmission services? We're going to try and call President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf back in Monrovia, because it's very important that we do hear that perspective from the president and, you know, from the country. Dr. Liu, one of the things I did hear President Johnson Sirleaf say there is that, you know, that Liberia, the population density is very, very high. And I'm just wondering whether that is, how can that be, how can we overcome that particular factor? Because it seems then that we're saying that the disease is going to run amok among the people if it's so densely populated.
First of all, it's very difficult to predict how the Ebola will transmit in a very dense population, but we are having major concern of how it happened. I think one of the best key thing, as I said before, is the community increased awareness about what is Ebola and what to do to prevent itself from being infected, implementing the what I call the universal precaution everywhere, and making sure that people consult as soon as they have symptoms.
Is that happening in Liberia? Because we're hearing that people are hiding away. They're trying to stop health workers from taking sick people away. So how effective are the communication networks in trying to convey these messages?
I cannot comment on how effective it is, but we have the experience that when an Ebola epidemic starts, it's always a challenge to bring the community on board because they don't understand what is going on and they are scared. And being scared is normal. So this is why we need to inform them and tell them what it's all about. So that's our, I would say, best asset.
Thank you very much, Dr. Joanne Liu there. Let's go to Guinea, where it all started back in March. We've got Dr. Kodugo Mustafa Sano on the line. Good evening to you, sir. Give us just a sit rep of what is happening in Guinea.
Thank you very much for calling me. Let me say, as your first speaker spoke about the situation in Guinea as well as in neighboring countries, it is true that we have been in this crisis from almost 5 months. And as of today, we are just leading towards, I'm not saying the end, but it is the management, it is a little bit has overcome the status of panic, the status of where it was very difficult for us. The time I'm talking to you, we have in Conakry itself, which is the capital, we are having only 3 patients in the hospital, the center of treatment. In the whole country, we are talking about 12 to 13 people have been just ordered in the hospitals. Meaning to say, on daily basis, the number is decreasing, is getting down, and we are expecting at the end of this, at the beginning of the next 2-3 days, we'll be having less than 10 patients in our hospitals.
So as far as you, from your point of view, then you're winning this battle. Why would you say that's happening? Definitely. What are you doing to be able to make these success, claims of success?
Thank you very much. We had benefited the support of the international community. You may know WHO, MSF, CDC, all of this international community, they came forward to Guinea since March. And they have been working hand in hand with the government and working, strategizing, getting tracing the contract, making sure that every single contract is followed and putting in place a system that and mechanism that had helped us today. We can discover, we can just know the trace of any patient, any contact, any any affected person within the next 24 hours. So, at the same time, the treatment of these people who have been confirmed in the centers, out of nine towns were affected at the beginning. We are left today with something around 2. If you add Conakry, it's going to be 3. And then in each of these centers, in Conakry itself, we are having 3 people. We are having the second town, which is Sigiri. We are having another 3 people over there. These people, they are going to go out of the hospital because the result of the test which has been conducted to these people. Well, so this is confirmed. I think the management, the contribution from the international community, we have benefited these contributions, and our technicians on the ground on a daily basis, we have been tracing and we have been coordinating with everybody and making sure that the things should be controlled as soon as possible. We don't have any reason to continue handling this business for the next month to come.
Thank you, Dr. Kodugo Mustafa Sano. So, Dr. Joanne Liu, Guinea, they're reporting that they are certainly not going to be battling with Ebola for the next 6 months. But do you agree with his assessment in general of what of the situation on the ground? Is that what it looks like to you from Geneva?
So I just returned from Guinea last night, and then I saw for myself that the number of cases have stabilized, and it's I would say now in terms of numbers, what we are facing, it's small little cluster that is happening. And often those cases are imported cases. So the thing is, it's true that in terms of the general big chain of transmission, this has decreased enormously. And now what we need to do in Guinea is to continue the good work and not, I would say, let down the guard in terms of Ebola vigilance.
I'm just wondering whether or not it's the case in Guinea that the infections have run their course, because it's been there for nearly 6 months, or is it indeed because of good practices? I'm asking that question.
You're asking this to me. Sorry, I thought it was a statement.
Well, continue if you can answer it, and then I'll go to Dr.
I think that it's very difficult to answer because we are in, I would call it, an unknown gray zone right now. But the reality is Guinea has scaled up in terms of its response to the Ebola crisis. They have got the upper hand on the epidemic. And that is good because it shows us that it's possible to contain the epidemics. And what we need to do now in Sierra Leone and in Liberia is to scale up the response.
Just very briefly, Dr. Kodugo Mustafa Sano, so when do you think Guinea will be able to declare that it's Ebola-free?
I think that what we have to do with our partners, especially MSF as well as WHO, we have decided at the beginning of this crisis that we will not be handling alone. We have to go to the international community and seek the advice, as they have been doing it always. As the lady who spoke to you, exactly that we are having on daily basis meetings with the partners, meeting with the specialists, meeting the technicians, and following up at all levels, from the president's office to the layman on the ground. And the sensitization is going on at all levels. We are not leaving a single doubt for any area where it's needed to be, or that we have to be over there. So to declare, I think we'll have to go back to our partners. They have been our good advisors. They have been good partners. They have been helping us at all levels. I think it will be something good for us once the good news will come out. They will best to announce it for us.
Dr. Kodugo Mustafa Sano there. We have President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf back on the line, and I hope that the quality of the telephone line that we're talking to her is better so that we can hear what she's saying. President, welcome back. You know, I was struck by an interview that I had with a Liberian health worker last week who complained that they didn't have proper equipment. They didn't have gloves, for instance. They were reusing their gloves. I'm wondering whether that situation has improved now.
That situation has indeed improved considerably as we have now received supplies from the Global Health, from some of our partners, and a very large supply from the People's Republic of China that was airlifted to us. We are now in the process of distributing those supplies to all of our subdivisions to help workers in the counties, to some of our local government authorities that are doing awareness. So, yes, it has improved considerably. We still need more, and we still have to do more effective distribution to try to reach the most remotest places, but the improvement is just there.
I can hear that the line is fraying again, but I'd like to use this opportunity to bring in Kim Chakanetsa, who's been gathering social media comments, from various people that we've been inviting to comment on this. I'd like, Kim, if you could put some of the comments that you've heard and also maybe questions to the president and our other guests on the line so that they can respond to that.
Yes, certainly. I'd like to start by a question from Edgar Chitukutuku in Kitwe, Zambia. And he wants to know how many lives have been claimed thus far by the Ebola virus in Liberia.
That's to you, President Johnson Sirleaf. How many people have died so far in Liberia?
In Liberia, we have 365 deaths. And of these, we have healthcare workers.
Now, another question from Samuel Suluku from Sierra Leone wants to know whether the government's been too slow in declaring the outbreak as an emergency. That's for you.
No, the government has tried. The government has been doing its best, trying to build our capacity in response to an unknown deadly disease, trying to make sure that we get the right supplies, getting technical help. The expertise that's required to be able to train our people to deal with this, to avoid putting lots of people at risk, including health workers, has taken us a little bit of time. But fortunately now we have our structures and our systems in place. Our capacity is much better, and we can now try to make our response more effective and more timely.
Now, one more question from Doris Maholo Saidi from in Monrovia, and she wants to know how much money has been committed to the fight against Ebola and how has it been used?
Well, let me say that right now, $5 million has been put in an Ebola trust fund, which comes out of the government budget. We have received commitments from the World Bank. We've received commitments from some of our partners, but no commitment has yet turned into cash other than government's own resources. Now, many of our partners have made contributions directly to WHO, which has put out a $200 million appeal, and also they have made certain contribution directly to non-governmental organizations such as Medicine Sans Frontières, Samaritan Purse, UNICEF, many others. And so we are trying to make sure that we get all this information so we can have a comprehensive report that can be made to the Liberian people and to our donors.
Those are questions there.
Those commitments to turn into cash.
Thanks, President Johnson Sirleaf. Those are questions that we harvested from our social media platforms and also from Facebook. Here's a question about the way in which Patrick Sawyer was able to travel to Nigeria. Although various authorities in Liberia knew that he was on the Ebola watch list, but he was still cleared to travel. How could that have happened?
Let me just say to you that this is the most unfortunate thing that that Mr. Sawyer went to Nigeria knowing that he was probably are inspected. But government did not know officially of Mr. Chawla. Yes.
Didn't the health ministry know?
No, the health ministry had asked him to turn to come in to be able to be tested. And my understanding is that he was irresponsible. He disrespected the advice that had been given to him. And he traveled despite that. Most unfortunate that he acted this way. It has hurt not only our country, but it's also hurt our sub-region, and that's very, very sad that he acted in this irresponsible manner.
You're blaming him for it, but there was also, I mean, his for instance, his employers also knew. Don't you feel that they should have alerted the government rather than, you know, sort of relying on the health ministry only, you know, and just his actions? Because he was clearly a sick man.
We should have been informed and had been informed by the employer. If even anybody in our ministry had really taken it to be seriously, which it was, we would never have let Mr. Sawyer leave here. If need be, we would have arrested him at the airport. Unfortunately, it didn't reach the level where those kinds of instructions could have been given.
Your country is now isolated because a whole lot of international airlines have stopped flying there. You've also instituted a state of emergency to deal with the outbreak. I'm just wondering, how well are those measures working, especially the isolation of people and the movement of people in different areas?
The measures are working. We have to continue to be vigilant. Our country has supported the free movement of people. That has been one of the reasons why this disease continues to be transmitted from one area to the other. And this is why we've had to put some strict measures. We've had to put security forces. We've quarantined some places. We've established roadblocks to restrict movement of people. It became necessary because of that.
How are you able to feed people in those areas? Sorry, Madam President. How are you able to feed people in those areas?
We are allowing food to go. Commercial food would be allowed. They have to go through some measures of having drivers and whatnot check and precautionary measures. But commercial food is going, and in cases where we have quarantined the places, we are sending free food. The government is sending food to those places.
Thank you very much. That's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia there on the line. She'll be staying with us for the rest of the hour. And also Dr. Kodogo Mustafa Sano from Guinea, the cooperation minister, is also on the line. And we have Joanne Liu from Médecins Sans Frontières joining us from Geneva. We will be discussing these questions and others, also your Facebook comments and your text messages that you've been sending in the course of the day. And we'll also be joined by other experts that will be joining us to discuss the impact, the economic and the social impact of the Ebola virus. My name is Audrey Brown, and this is Focus on Africa. Our top story today, the president of Médecins Sans Frontières, Joanne Liu, says it will take at least 6 months to bring the Ebola epidemic in West Africa under control. Calling for more help from the international community, she also urged greater leadership from the World Health Organization. Coming up after the news, the MSF boss is live on the program, and together with the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, we continue our discussion about the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa. Why has it been so difficult to contain the virus? What impact has the outbreak had on affected countries? What can be done to contain it? And of course, we will be discussing the economic fallout as well. We'll be exploring these issues with a panel of experts from around the continent and taking questions from you, our listeners, via our BBC Africa social media pages. You're listening to a special edition of Focus on Africa. Tonight, we are discussing the Ebola outbreak and asking, how can the spread of this hemorrhagic fever be stopped? I'm Audrey Brown. We're going to take some questions from a few callers on the line. When I do come to you, please put your question directly to the guest. You'd like to answer it for you if you can, and be brief and succinct if possible. We had in the last half hour a President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from Liberia. Unfortunately, her line has dropped. But we also have Dr. Kodugo Mustafa Sano, who is the Minister for Cooperation from Guinea. And we have Joanne Liu from Médecins Sans Frontières, and she is in Geneva. I want to go also to one of the people that we have in our studio here. It's Obi Sise, political analyst from Sierra Leone. You wanted to respond to something that you heard on the program earlier from President Johnson Sirleaf.
Yes, I mean, it's quite shocking when we start to hear African presidents blaming Ebola patients for the spread of the outbreak. Then it starts to become quite shocking. The truth of the matter is the response to Ebola, both from the WHO and local governments, is bordering on criminally negligent. And I say this because today we are, what, 8 months, 9 months, nearly 9 months into the outbreak?
No, six, actually.
Six, well, no, the first case was in December, if we check. The very first case was in December.
Well, we did
Guinea.
Check, and we didn't quite find that reference. So the first known reported case was in March, at the end of March.
I think you're wrong. If you will find that it has been reported recently that patient X has been identified as a child in December in Guinea. But never mind. Let's say it's for March. Let's not waste our time on pedantics. The truth of the matter is, from March to now, we still have cases of Ebola bodies being left for long periods of time because there are no body bags. We still have cases of people who bury Ebola patients not having gloves to bury them. In some cases, they're having to wash the gloves and reuse them.
Are you talking about Sierra Leone
specifically? I'm talking about Sierra Leone specifically. Okay. We still have cases of people going into hospital and not getting treatment. This is not Ebola related. They're going in from... This is cholera season in West Africa. People are going in with cholera. People are going in with malaria. Pregnant women have bleeding problems and are going in. There was a case in Sierra Leone of a woman who bled to death because nobody would treat her because they didn't know whether she had Ebola or not. The health systems have completely collapsed.
Well, the one thing that sticks in my mind of what you said is that the organizations have been criminally negligent in this. But let's go very quickly to Sierra Leone. There are two guests on the line. Andrew, what would you like to say? It does what Obi Sise has been saying, does it correlate with what you're finding on the ground?
Yeah, I'm on the ground. And from the onset of the Ebola, you know, outbreak, actually, almost 11 weeks ago, we found out that there were lots of, you know, questions of, you know, denial of the patients and refusal to go, you know, to the hospitals until the establishment of the epicenter there. And then, of course, you know, getting MSF, you know, in there. But before that time, most of the patients have escaped. Some of them were initially brought to Kenema. And then also most of those ones, you know, that escaped went to family members and were seeking treatment, you know, privately. And subsequently, of course, most of them escaped to come to the capital thinking that they are going to get better treatment and, you know, get well. This is how actually the outbreak had moved from, you know, the eastern region, Kailaun, which is a very, very productive area in terms of agriculture, and in terms of businesses, and then to come all the way down, you know, to Freetown, which is the capital. Now
Thank
you find
you
out that
much.
Those that have also...
Sorry, Dr. Abdu Mwana, Vice President of the Sierra Leone Medical and Dental Association. I just want to bring in Phileas Jusu, who's representing religious leaders on a task force on Ebola. We're hearing quite damning evidence here, well, damning testimonies from people about this. I'm just wondering, do you feel that everything that can be done is being done, given the resources that are available for this?
I wouldn't say so, but I want to focus more on the level we are now. The level we are now, the disease has moved, like Dr. just said, from Kailaun to the capital. Out of the 14 districts in Sierra Leone, we only have one district that is not affected yet. So I think we as religious group are focusing more on a united force, on what we all can do now. Ebola is a strange disease for all West Africans. It caught us, all of us, unaware. We didn't know what to do. The governments were struggling as to what to put in place. And we don't want to begin the blame game now because we think we are a bit late for that. We are thinking of a united front, how everybody can play their role. The religious group is formed a task force that is responding by training people, health workers, pastors, imams, and sharing with them the messages coming from the health ministry. The health ministry together with UNICEF have worked so well. They have put together Ebola information packages in terms of leaflets. These are the ones we are all using to go into communities and to train people.
Thank you very much.
So that is where we are. We are also focusing on social support for affected families and infected people.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from DJ Bass in Sierra Leone, who's been receiving calls and speaks to people on a daily basis about this. DJ Bass, can you give us an overview of what people are telling you on the ground in Sierra Leone?
Well, a lot of people usually call on my show and then give feedback about what they think about Ebola. At first, on the first interview, a lot of people were having doubts whether the disease is real. And as you heard, one of my colleagues said, it's a new disease to Sierra Leone. At first, a lot of people were not believe that the sick is real. But for now, I think the perception has really changed because a lot of people now believe it's real because of the death of so many medical people. And, I mean, a lot of people believe now it's real. They've seen victims. At first, so many people said they were not seeing victims, but now we had people who come from the provinces calling to my show and said they now believe the disease is real. But when you go around and then talk to people, and sometimes when people even call on my show, they even say they still don't believe it's real. Some say it's a money-making thing. The white men want to sell the drugs. And why is it now that they are finding Zima to heal the disease? And I think that's a complicated thing.
Thank you very much, DJ Bass. I'm going to turn to John Oxford, who's a professor of virology at Queen Mary University of London. You've heard some of the misgivings that people have had there, Professor Oxford, specifically talking about, you know, the treatment of it and the vaccine and so on. But let's talk about why Ebola is so scary for people.
Well, I think there's no doubt about that it's scary, both for doctors, nurses, and you, me, and the patients. And I think it's the blood, isn't it? It's hemorrhaging blood, it's the rash, and it's the thought of quite a high risk of death, maybe 50%. Now, I can understand all that. But all these things I've been hearing, they're not different from things that have happened in the past in Europe. And I'm in Ireland at the moment, and a lady was telling me today when the tuberculosis outbreaks were happening in the 50s, the same attitude, exactly the same. Families didn't want to disclose a case because it would bring a black mark onto the family and so on. So it's just, you know, obviously not such a bad disease, but the same sort of phenomenon and the same sort of blame and the same sort of difficulty in getting a balanced picture. And I think here, what we really have to also, I mean, I know I'm not there, and it might be easy for me to say, but we're not dealing with many cases here, considering the population in those areas of millions of people. We're dealing with just a handful, really. I mean, 1,000 deaths. I know they're horrible, but it's not as though this thing is raging along. We're dealing with a very, very small numbers. And I've got sympathy for WHO. I think they are doing their best. I've got particular sympathy and for medicine and respect for Medicine Sans Frontières. And if they're saying it's going to last several more months, I would quite accept that. But I'm sure that the numbers will go down and down and down. That's what we want to see. And
We're already hearing that in Guinea. Professor Oxford, let's talk about vaccines and cures and, you know, incomplete samples that are being used. How well are the ones working, the ZMAP, for instance, that was being used on the Liberian medics?
Well, I don't think we know yet because, you know, new therapies, although we have some evidence, there's quite a lot of background evidence of serum therapy, that is, you take antibodies from recovered animals or people and transfuse it. There's quite a lot of background science behind all this, and it should work. And I think this particular example of the tobacco plant extract, that should work particularly well. And I think they've done some animal work anyway. But, of course, there's not much available at this precise moment, and the people who get it will be lucky. But the vaccine, I mean, there's been experimental work done on vaccines over the last perhaps 5 years. But again, that sort of thing, more so than the serum therapy, the vaccine program will have to start quite slowly. I couldn't imagine that sort of program starting anywhere in the field for another at least another year. So really, once back to basics here, we are dependent on everyone keeping away from funerals, basically, because that's where people are catching it. They're not catching it in the street. They're not catching it from the wind. They're catching it from intimate contact with a case.
And, of course, we know how difficult it is for people to stay away from funerals, for instance.
Yes. I think but the most practical thing, and I know it's easy for some foreigner like me to say it, but if for even a temporary win, I think this is where it would be wonderful to have the full support, and it sounds to me as though you're getting it, from religious leaders and traditional healers. If they can suspend their normal way of behaviour at funerals and encourage people to do the same, that is, keep away from funerals, not touch dead bodies, and you're going to have to bag up the dead body and so on and so forth, that will be the single most thing, apart from the high level of hygiene, washing your hands with very hot water or disinfectant or chlorine.
Thank you very much, Professor John Oxford there. Let's go to Professor Udo Schuklenk to talk a little bit about the medical ethics concerned here. Very many people were very worried, for instance, that the first offer of the vaccine that was available was made to two American medics and then, subsequently to Liberian medics. I'm just wondering, what is the medical community's responsibility in this regard?
You know what makes it so complicated is that there is no vaccine and there is no treatment. And we have seen a lot of misreporting in the media about what is or isn't available, right? So we have basically supposedly therapeutic agents that at this stage probably have been tested on 5 people. We don't know whether they help these people, because when you look at the current mortality rate, it's about, 55-60% of people die. So there's a very large percentage of people surviving, actually, an infection with this virus. So we don't know whether those 5 that got it, whether they survived because they got this particular agent, or they would have survived anyway because they got, good clinical care, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Udo Schuklenk there. Kim Chakanetsa has got some questions that we've been harvesting from our Facebook and social media platforms.
This question is for Joanne Liu of Médecins Sans Frontières. The listener wants to know, what are the protective materials or clothing that health workers need to be using to protect them from the disease?
Well, in the medical care center of MSF, where we have patient or confirmed cases, we are wearing what we call a full gear personal protection for Ebola. So it's a suit and there's a hood and goggles with boots. So that's a full barrier to make sure that none of our staff will be exposed to body fluids.
Now, I have 2 other quick questions, both sort of related. The first is from Dekon T, and she wants to know, is the virus ever present in breast milk?
That's a very good question, and apparently there is a risk of contamination with breast milk, and so we discourage breastfeeding for people who are infected. If you allow me, I would like to come back on one of the comments of one of our guests before around the funerals. And we know that funerals is a moment that if we have someone who was infected, who died, can be a vector of infection. And we all agreed on that. But I think what we need to make sure is that if we are asking a relative of the person who died to change a behavior or ritual around funeral, it needs to be acceptable. And so what we've been trying to implement where we are working right now, it's that MSF, we disinfect the body and we treat the body, and after that we ensure a safe burial that is acceptable to the ritual of the community.
Thank you very much, Dr. Joanne Liu there from Médecins Sans Frontières, speaking to us from Geneva. Now, we have 2 guests in the studio here, Obe Sise, who is a political analyst from Sierra Leone, and also Manji Cheto, who is a risk analyst for West Africa. Manji, I'm going to ask you about, we've been listening to the social consequences and the political consequences of this, but let's look at the economic consequences. What kind of a knock can countries expect from this? You know, flights are being cancelled, borders are closed, economic activity suspended in large parts of various countries.
Well, I think there's two ways that you can look at this. On the one hand, there's a direct impact on the rural economies, and then there's a direct impact on the kind of macro picture for these countries. On the rural economy, I mean, the main impact is going to come from the closure of borders. We know that those three countries, Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone, have cross-border trade going on. The governments have taken the measure to actually shut down those borders. So we know that that's going to have a direct impact on the livelihoods of those local communities. But from looking at the kind of bigger macro picture for these countries, if you consider the fact that export commodities and agriculture, particularly for Liberia and Guinea, are the main drivers for foreign exchange in these countries. And we know that the regions that have been affected are regions that are producing these commodities, in the case of Sierra Leone, cocoa and coffee, and for Liberia, timber and rubber. So we know that, you know, with some of these companies that are involved in these sectors announcing partial shutdown of operations, that's going to have a direct impact on production and therefore on government revenues as well.
Tell me something. You know, I mean, we're looking at a country like Ghana being affected. There hasn't even been a case in Ghana. Is there an element of sort of overreaction going on here?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of African governments, unfortunately, could suffer as a result of this, because the international community has, you know, moved in some cases to the flight bans. I mean, that's going to affect particularly countries that have got that rely on tourism. And we've seen Korean Airways actually ban flights to Nairobi. I mean, this is already a country that relies heavily on the tourism sector. The tourism sector has come under a lot of pressure from rising insecurity. And to have the flight bans, I mean, these are some of the things that could have negative knock-on effects on the African economy.
And of course, Kenya Airways is coming under pressure from within Kenya to stop flights to and from West Africa. Obviously, you know, I'm struck by the fact that we often blame the media for overreacting or for underreporting, you know. Politically, though, I'm wondering whether it is right that we talk about Ebola in the way that we are in these terms.
It is right that we talk about Ebola in this term. I have spent the last several weeks since I came back. I was born in Kenema, incidentally, one of the epicenters in Sierra Leone, and I was there in July. I live less than a mile away from the isolation unit. When I came back, I started speaking to Ebola experts, some with 10, 15 years experience. What they have been telling me is that one of the key issues with Ebola is transparency, because with transparency, you can achieve the social mobilization that you need. You need anthropologists to help you craft the message. You need to provide workshops for local journalists to help them understand how to propagate the message of Ebola. Social mobilization through the media is an extremely powerful tool in controlling Ebola. Just a quick point on the economic aspects. My fellow guest was making some excellent points about the wider economic ramifications of mining, agriculture, oil and gas, tourism, and what have you. But let's talk about the present economic effects as pertain on the ground today. In some of the areas where that have been quarantined, you have significant food price inflation already happening. So you have a starvation and food security problem on one side. There's shortages of things going in. Businesses are struggling. They need support. All of these things are going on at the moment. We should have a plan to deal with them.
Thank you very much, Obe Cisse there, and also Tumanji Cheto, a risk analyst for West Africa. Professor Abdusalam Nasidi, who's the chairman of the Center for Disease Control in Nigeria, is on the line. Oh, dear, the line has dropped. Unfortunately, I was looking forward to speaking to him because we hadn't heard from Nigeria particularly. Well, let's come back to the political ramifications and political discussions of this with you, Obe Cisse. You know, people very often say that, you know, Africa is regarded as one country. So there's Ebola in Africa, not even in West Africa. I mean, I'm laughing about it, but it is one of those sort of, you know, it's a wry laugh, isn't it? And I see you both shaking your heads about this.
Yes, we would. I mean, my fellow analyst and myself, I mean, I do political, economic, financial and security risk analysis. A lot of the time when I would be advising clients from Lloyd's Markets in London, I'd be looking at them giving me risk ratings for countries that were completely off whack. If anybody tried to sell you a cloak and said, this is an African cloak, make sure it has many different colors, because Africa is not homogeneous. It is not the same. However, the investment community and international finance tends to latch onto stories on Bloomberg and attribute risk ratings, which affect the interest that you would demand for your investments in those countries.
Well, you're actually talking to one, to a risk analyst there, Manjit Chetu. Are you guilty?
No, I'm not. I used to be a risk analyst.
Well, I'm just saying, but that is one of the questions that we have to answer, isn't it?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, yes, Africa does suffer from this kind of image of people looking at it as a homogenous market. But you know, markets at the end of the day are, in some respect, have to be quantified as singular units. I mean, we talk about the European market. We talk about the African market, the West African market. So to an extent, yes, that's the way that the financial investors will look at it. But at the same time, I mean, I think the key problem for a lot of these economies is people not distinguishing between risks that are very particular to those countries versus risks that are particular to a broader collective market.
Obviously, so you want to come back in there.
Yes, I just wanted to make a point to underline what she was saying there. When I was a risk analyst working in the City of London, there was a coup in Niger. Do you know that the price of oil for a very short period shot up on the international oil trading markets? Because most of the analysts who were trading oil thought the coup was in Nigeria. Now, that is the level of ignorance that pertains in international markets about Africa and, by extension, about the risk in Africa. Now, the WHO initially told us that Ebola cannot fly, and so it's being contained in West Africa. Now we have it in Guinea. But we did
hear the Liberian president respond to that specifically.
Yes, no, I'm just saying generally about the economic effects. Now the WHO is saying Kenya is at high risk because it is a high transport zone.
I need to clarify that, actually. I think that statement was taken out of context. It was a misrepresentation of an unofficial statement. That was actually not an official WHO statement. And I think it's just important to clarify that, because that has actually gone around for a little
bit. And we have spoken to the World Health Organization about that. Thank you very much to Manjit Chetu and Obisise. Let's go to Dr. Chikwe Iyekihazu, who is Nigerian, is currently in Malawi. And you have experience, Dr. Iyekihazu, of dealing with previous Ebola outbreaks. Can we draw this to a close in a way by talking about what can be learned from the previous outbreaks and what's happening now?
Yes, you know, this is a lot more complex situation. And there's been, obviously, we've all been attracted by the discussion on drugs that may have some impact on the clinical state of affairs of the patient. But ultimately,
I think the line has dropped or disappeared, unfortunately. I will try and get you back again, because it would be very valuable to hear from Nigeria and the experiences also of the past and, you know, the lessons that can be learned from the outbreaks that had happened in other parts of Africa and what we can learn from that now. But my guests in studio, and also Professor John Oxford, who's professor of virology there, is still on the line. From what you've been hearing, Professor John Oxford, what can the medical profession do that would allow people to have a greater understanding of Ebola? Because, for instance, you hear that the rate of infection, people are infectious between 2 and 21 days, and that information you don't find in one place necessarily.
No, I suspect myself. Do remember that we're all struggling along here. You know, this has been over the past 40 years, these outbreaks have been occurring, but there's not been a huge effort, I would say. So let's look positively here. I think from this outbreak, it might seem confused at the moment, but it will go down. The figures will go down with this focus on where you catch it and increase hygiene. The figures will go down. And then I think from this outbreak, we'll learn a lot more, and that will help us in the next outbreak. Because do remember, this one can be forced down and will be forced down, but the reservoir is still going to be there. In the 10th parallel, the 10th latitudes, north or south of the equator, that's the Ebola zone, whether it's going east or west, and that's presumably because the bat is there. So all this will happen again. So I'm hoping that this, being the biggest outbreak, everyone will focus on it, we will all learn from it, and I think action can then be taken to prevent or ameliorate the next outbreak, which could occur, say, the year after next.
Thank you very much, Professor John Oxford, Professor of Virology there. Obesisa, you said you had a question before we let Dr. Joan Liu from MSF go. Please put your question.
Yes, Dr. Joan Liu, you've been dealing with this across three countries over the last couple of months, and everything I hear is that your resources are overstretched and you're suffering human resource capabilities-wise. Do you think it's just if we increased, if the funding for Ebola support was increased, it would be a straightforward matter of scaling up the human resource capabilities that you have? Or do you think we need not just cash, but far more technical bodies on the ground?
I think that for the organization of Médecins Sans Frontières right now, the scaling up will be difficult because we're working in other contexts where it necessitates a lot of human resources. And then the main thing is Central African Republic, where we have over 2,500 staff. In South Sudan, we have 3,500 staff. So those crises has been taking a lot of our human resources in the field. The other thing, and let me just finish.
I'm so sorry. Resources. Unfortunately, we've got 10 seconds left for the program. I do apologize for that, Dr. John Liu from MSF, Manji Cheto, and also to you, Obesise. Thank you for joining us.